collusion with things, and I haven't. That's a little hard to answer. Partly, perhaps, it may be linked to the fact that back in the 1990, after the SSRIs had come on the market in the UK first, I was among the first people who would have used these drugs, put people on them.
So these are the SSRIs, the antidepressants like Prozac and Paxil and Effexor?
Yes. And putting people on these drugs, they were, the pills did help some, but they also made other people anxious and nervous and become suicidal. This seemed very obvious and clear to me. But when I tried to report it, when I tried to write it up as an article to outline what could happen on these pills, when I tried to talk to colleagues about what I was seeing happen, the response I got was that people just didn't believe it. I was being told that, you know, you're just wrong. The things that you say you're seeing in front of your eyes, that these just aren't happening. Now, I don't think I'm a good person. I don't think I'm better than any of the other doctors that have closer links to industry now than I have. But what I think I am is a slightly stubborn person. And when I'm being told that the white I can see in front of me is actually black, I tend to dig my heels in and say, well, no, it's white. And I think that's probably what happened. And in order to try and support the evidence of my own eyes, I came to doubt the evidence that other people were offering me. I mean, what we've had is a world where 30 to 40 years ago, if a doctor put you on a pill and you and they saw a thing happening to you, both of you tended to believe that the drug could cause it, and the usual response was to halt the pill. And if the problem cleared up, most people agreed the drug had caused it. But increasingly, with people becoming suicidal on Prozac, what the company and the regulators like FDA did was to say, well, we've got people on one side saying they think they see this happening, but that's anecdotal. The clinical trial evidence shows that it's not happening. That if you're going to be properly scientific, you should believe the evidence from clinical trials and not the evidence of your own eyes. Now, I guess I just found that unacceptable. And I still, to this day, tend to say that we should believe the evidence of our own eyes. And if the clinical trial evidence points to a different outcome, then we need to think about, well, are we being shown all of the clinical trial evidence? What is it that's caused clinical trials to go wrong and produce the wrong answer?
And so was your challenging the perceived wisdom around suicide risk in the antidepressants, was that what led you to lose your position at the Toronto Center for Addictions and Mental Health?
Yes, it was. Around 1990, when the first reports came out in the United States by Teicher et al., there was a very famous article which came out of Harvard by a group of Boston psychiatrists saying that Prozac could cause people to become suicidal. Around just the same time, I had had a patient whom I had put on the drugs, in fact, two patients, and they had become suicidal. So I tended to believe the Teicher et al. Report and wrote my own article up and also began to talk about the issue. So over the course of the next 10 years or so, I gave a few talks and wrote a few different articles saying that this kind of thing could happen, and gave more talks and wrote more articles about other problems that pills could cause, like getting hooked to the antipsychotics or getting hooked to the SSRIs or things like this. Around 1999, I was approached by the University of Toronto to move over there to a post there, and they would have known pretty clearly the views that I had, but they still seemed to think that it was a good idea to have me there. And I was interviewed and offered a job and said yes and was preparing to move. When they held a meeting, it was a meeting to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the university department and the 150th anniversary of the mental health service there. And they asked a bunch of very big names in the field to come and talk, including me. One of the other people who was there was a person called Charlie Nemiroff. And at the time, Charlie Nemiroff was the professor of psychiatry at Emory University and was widely regarded as the most powerful man in the mental health field. His support or lack of support could make or break people. At the time, he was to be an expert witness in legal trials on the opposite side of the argument to me. I had gotten involved around this time in a few different cases where people who had either committed suicide or homicide or things like this on an antidepressant had legal cases, and the lawyers trying to find experts found that they couldn't. I mean, these were all cases that were being heard over in the States, but the lawyers there couldn't find any experts that were prepared to give expert input for them, so they had to go abroad. They had to go overseas, and they tracked me down, and I said, sure, fine, you know, I've got the view that these drugs can cause problems. Let's be clear, though. I mean, there may be loads of people who go on these pills and go on to commit suicide on them or go on to commit homicide on them, and I will think that the drug hasn't caused a problem. So just because it can cause a problem doesn't mean that it always has. You've got to look at the case closely and work out if in this case it in fact did cause it or not. So in the case that I was involved in that Charlie Nemeroff appeared to also be involved in, it seemed to me quite clear that the drug had caused the problem. This is a man called Don Schell, who at the time was 60, and he'd been put on Paxil 48 hours previously. As it turned out, he'd had a history which the doctor who put him on the Paxil didn't know, which was a history of responding poorly to SSRI-like drugs. That's drugs like Paxil. And 48 hours after he was put on the Paxil, he put 3 bullets to the head of his wife, 3 bullets to the head of his daughter, 3 bullets to the head of his granddaughter before killing himself. Now, this was a very critical case for a number of reasons, and I had agreed to get involved. And this was around the time that I was supposed to be moving to Toronto also. And at a previous meeting, Charlie Nemeroff had made it clear that he didn't think that it was a good idea that I'd be involved in this case, and he didn't like the research that I was doing to show that the drugs could cause a problem, and that it might be the end of my career if I weren't careful. And sure enough, after the meeting in Toronto, at which he gave a talk also, and where the talk that I gave was rated by the audience as the best talk that day, and the one that he gave was rated as one of the poorest talks that day, he had a word with the university and told them that they didn't really want to hire me. It wasn't a great idea. And later on that evening and over the next few days, the university thought about it, and they got in touch with me and told me they were going to terminate the appointment. So it was very interesting, to say the least.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and our guest today is David Healy. He's professor of psychiatry at Cardiff University in Wales and has published more than 200 publications in peer-reviewed scientific journals. He's the author of 22 books and is co-founder of Risk.org. So that led to a $6.4 million settlement from Paxil. That was the drug that Schell was on when he committed these murders, a settlement against GlaxoSmithKline. Is that right? So you won that case.
Yes, it was actually the first time that a company had ever lost a case based on a behavioral effect of their drug.
And then after that, were warnings put on the antidepressant drugs that they could cause to suicidal and violent behavior?
No, it took a few years. It took 3 years after that case, probably 4 years after that case. In 2004, that's when the FDA hearings happened, which put the black box warnings on these drugs for children. Now, in fact, these drugs cause just as many problems for all age groups. It's not just children that they cause, that they can cause problems for. They can cause the same kind of problems for any age group.
So, David, in the Schell case, there were 3 people that were murdered by this man who was on Paxil, but the scope of the injuries and deaths that are caused by adverse medications, not just psychiatric medications, is enormous and underreported and underaddressed.
The estimate from FDA is that somewhere between 1 in 100 and 1 in 20 of the serious problems that drugs cause get reported to them. What will probably happen is in the 1 in 20 group, there'll be the people who go on an antidepressant, say, and maybe become obviously homicidal, possibly suicidal. Very clear things happen to them. And it's easy for the person who's on the pill to see them happening. So that'll lead to them being reported. But, you know, you can go on antidepressants as well, and most antidepressants actually affect the way the heart works. And this can lead you to just drop dead out of the blue. Your heart can begin to misfire. Now, that's the kind of thing which you're not, as a person on the pills, you're not going to be aware that the pills could be causing this. So that kind of event probably gets reported even less than 1 in 100, possibly no more than 1 in 1,000 of the people that have the problem actually get a report filed that they have a problem. When you bring your children to the doctor to be treated, and the doctor isn't keeping an eye on what could go wrong, that isn't keeping an eye on whether your child's going to get to where they need to get, it's quite extraordinary that we let this happen. You know, that we don't insist on people keeping a very, very close eye on just what actually happens when you take one of these pills. And in fact, it's very, very short-sighted, because to this day, the single best way to discover new pills still is by keeping a close eye on what actually happens to them. That, you know, when people take the drug for one reason and a completely different thing happens, like when they took Viagra for their heart and found that completely different things happened, that's still the best way for us all to find the new pills that we need for the various different things that we still need new pills for.
So even though the adverse effects of pharmaceutical prescriptions is a very high number of deaths and injuries that are caused every year around the world, you're saying that that's actually a very, very small percentage of what's actually happening.
You and I, when we go on pills, think we're the consumer of the pills. But from the point of view of the pharmaceutical company, we're not. The people who consume the pill is the doctor who prescribes. And these doctors, when they prescribe you and me a pill, they consume it without anything going wrong. The things that go wrong for me and you, but the doctor consumes the pill by giving it to us, and things don't go wrong for the doctor who put us on the pill. It's not, I mean, we're in a completely different kind of situation to the pilot that flies us from Los Angeles to New York, say, where if we end up going down and being killed, she is also. But the doctor that puts us on the pill, the doctor that tries to fly us from having an arthritis problem to not having one, well, if we get killed, they aren't. You know, they're just fine.
Do you think this raises a question about the role of the private market and the profit incentive in healthcare?
There's problems that happen over in the States, where things are much more privatized than they are here in Europe. But we have comparable problems here in Europe. And in lots of respects, the pharmaceutical industry prefer when medicine's socialized and run by insurance companies and things like that, rather than when it's actually private. And they prefer the drugs to be available on prescription only, rather than over the counter.
So in your view, the real issue is the regulatory and oversight function has failed here.
There's a few different things. One is we've left the industry worldwide persuade us all that clinical trials are the only thing that actually counts, rather than the evidence of our own eyes. We've also let them conceal, hide the data from the clinical trials. In any other area of science, if I was to make a claim and didn't show people the data that supports that claim, it would be the end of my career. But the pharmaceutical industry make all these claims without having to let anyone see the data behind the claims. Then there's the issue of the drugs being available on prescription only. It seemed to be a good idea back in the 1950s, when this was done first, to make new drugs available on prescription only, because most people thought the average person in the street is not really aware of the risks that these pills pose, and doctors are much more skeptical about pills, and they'll be slow to put us on the pills that we may think it will be a good idea for us to be on. Now, in actual fact, since then, since 1962, when we put this kind of arrangement in place, industry have been spending the equivalent of close to $50,000 per doctor per year to try and win the hearts and minds of the true consumer of the pill, that's the doctor. And they really have captured their hearts and minds pretty completely. So that's a problem. And then finally, to come back to the private issue that you mentioned first, one of the things that we've done is we've over-rewarded industry. We've let them take patents out on drugs, and we've let them take a particular kind of patent out on drugs that gives them vast awards for drugs that are really scarcely beneficial at all to us. If we had the kind of system that encouraged them to make drugs for the conditions that we really need drugs for, and that ensure that the drugs that we get next year are going to be superior to the ones that we have now, then it will be worthwhile to pay huge prices. But in fact, we're getting drugs this year that are inferior to the ones we had 10 to 15 years ago, and we're paying vast amounts of money for these new drugs rather than using better, older, and cheaper drugs. This is a crazy system.
David, one of the things that you've written about recently is the invisibility issue, the way in which adverse effects, even when someone tells them to their doctor, the doctor may not believe them or may not end up being reported at all. Say something about that.
One of the key points behind risk.org is this. Because I'm aware, and because all of us who are involved in Risk are aware of how hard it can be to bring a problem like this to the doctors, put you on the pill, what we've done is to create a system where you can generate a report, a written report, which you can bring to the doctor of the problem that you've got. And we've taken you through a bunch of questions as well to try and pin it down. Has the drug you're on caused the problem you're having or not? So you get a score which indicates that it's likely that it has or not. And the reason to do this is because if you or I go and talk to the doctor and it's just talk, he doesn't need to record in the notes the things that we've actually said. And let's say we've felt very bad on this drug and that we feel that when we go out the door we're likely to do some awful thing. Well, if we go out the door and do an awful thing and end up dead and there's no record there, well, there's no problem for the doctor to put you on the pills. But if you walk in the door and you're holding a piece of paper which shows what the problem is and shows that it's likely that the drug could be linked to it and that you've been asked by us to go to your doctor, and he pays no heed to you and things do go wrong when you walk out the door, he's in a tricky position now. And the hope is that we want everyone who's on a pill to quality mark doctors to report back to all of us who are the doctors that listen and who are the ones that don't. And my hope is if we can create a network of doctors that people regularly say, these guys listen to us, versus the ones that don't, that we'll be able to force the ones that don't listen to begin to listen, or they'll go out of business.
David, we are just about out of time. Give us the contact information if people want to reach you and also how they can access risk.org and make use of the resources there.
Risk.org is spelled R-X-I-S-K rather than risk, R-R-I-S-K. If you go in there, you'll be able to contact me and all of the team linked to Risk also. But the key things are you'll be able to report your story. You'll be able to contribute to make medicines safer for all of us, and you'll have access to a huge amount of data for free that anywhere else, if you go to try and get this, you'll be charged for it. So what we're hoping is that people generally will go in there and use it. They don't have to contribute at all, but if they can add in the adverse events that have happened to them, they can help build up a body of evidence that will be generally helpful and good for all of us, and will hopefully persuade the politicians also that things can't keep going on the way they have been going on, that we need change.
David Healy, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Well, it was great. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to an interview with David Healy. He is professor of psychiatry at Cardiff University in Wales and has published more than 200 articles in peer-reviewed scientific journals. He's the author of 22 books and is the co-founder of RISK.org. That's RXISK.org. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, co-sponsored by the Icarus Project, Portland Hearing Voices, and Freedom Center. Madness Radio is hosted by Will Hall, and producer is Leah Harris. Madness Radio is based at KBOO in Oregon and can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network. Contact us at radio@madnessradio.net.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the JHS Annual Multicultural Film Festival's presentation of Two Americans. This documentary considers the status of undocumented immigrants in light of Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio's civil rights violations. This showing of Two Americans will be facilitated by Mr. Freddy Trujillo, who will lead the discussion following the movie. Two Americans will be shown at the North Portland Neighborhood Library at 512 North Killingsworth, on Tuesday, April 8th, starting at 6 p.m. More information on this event can be found online at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
It is 11:58, and you're tuned to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM. It is time now for the Noontime Jamboree. I'm Retta Christie. My guest today is Chris Tile. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Retta.
How are you today?
I'm excellent.
Hey, what about this weather?
Beautiful spring day here in Portland.
It's a beautiful spring day in Portland.
City of Roses. I haven't seen any yet, but...
No, but the tulips and daffodils are going to town.
They sure are.
Yes, they are. And I heard it's supposed to be like 75 today.
I just saw on my phone 71, but, you know...
I'll take it.
70s in April, that's pretty good.
It's very good. Well, okay, so it's springtime, and we have kind of a spring-themed show today. But first, I want to remind you that this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Wonder Ballroom, presenting the infamous String Dusters April 18th and Fruition April 19th. Tickets and information for the infamous String Dusters and Fruition April 18th and 19th at thewonderballroom.com. Well, let's get right to the music. yes, it's a springtime show here on the Noontime Jamboree. I'm writer Christy. My guest is Chris Tile. And Chris, you started us off with what today?
That was Mendelssohn's Spring Song, as played by Tommy Dorsey and his orchestra, from February 18th, 1937. Some great musicians in the band at that time. The tenor saxophonist was Bud Freeman. The marvelous drummer Dave Tough was on that track. Of course, Tommy Dorsey himself on the trombone.
Very nice. That's a good perky little number to start us off.
Yeah.
Well, the next cut that I have is also from 1937. And I noticed a cut that you also have on your list, but I'm getting to it first, Chris. So I'm going to play it. Do you know what it might be?
I haven't any idea.
It's Spring Cleaning by Fats Waller.
All right.
So here, Spring Cleaning.
That ain't the cleaner. Here it is. Yes, yes. I'll polish the leaves, make them green again, shake out the trees. She's seen again. Spring cleaning, getting ready for love. Sweep out the nook. Down in Lover's Lane, turn on the brook, make it run again. Spring cleaning, getting ready for love. Dust off the wintry bowers, wash them off with April showers. Cover them with fragrant flowers, shine up the silvery moon. Cause you and I have a rendezvous under the sky, like we used to do. Spring cleaning, getting ready for love.
Getting ready for love. No, it. Spring cleaning. That's what it is. Spring cleaning. Fats Waller from 1937.
That's the one. That's, you know, when I played that at home, that thing that Fats did, my cat went nuts when she heard that.
Yeah. She heard that.
She was like, you know, what in the world was that? She'd never heard a sound like that. I don't normally walk around the house doing that, so she was very confused about what that was.
Oh my. Oh, poor Pluff. Well, okay, so you have another version of Spring Cleaning.
Yeah, this is by a guy named Bob Howard. And I think that they were sort of, Fats and this guy were sort of friendly competitors in doing these kind of tunes. It's like one record label against the other. And I think Fats won. He seemed to have the better versions. But I thought it was interesting, the juxtaposition of the two tunes, the two different versions of the same tune, so...
All right.
Here it is. It's from, let's see, Fats's version was March 18th, 1937, and this was 6 days before, March 12th.
Oh, my. He beat him to the punch.
Yeah, he got it out sooner by 6 days.
All right.
Thank you. again, shake out the trees. Change the scene again, spring cleaning, getting ready for love. I'll sweep out the nook, down in Lover's Lane, turn on the brook, make it run again, spring cleaning, getting ready for love. I'll dust those wintry bowers, wash them out with April showers, cover them with fragrant flowers, sign up the silvery moon, 'cause soon you and I have a rendezvous under the sky, like we used to do, spring cleaning, getting ready for love. Swing out, boys.